It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. 2 weeks from today, the country marks the 50th anniversary of one of the great American tragedies of the 20th century, the assassination of President John Fitzgerald Kennedy. The memories of that day remain seared into the consciousness of anyone old enough to remember it. Kennedy's progressive vision for the country inspired many younger Americans who've never quite gotten over what happened on November 22, 1963.
Only a few generations have been granted the role of defending freedom in its hour of maximum danger. I do not shrink from this responsibility. I welcome it. The energy, the faith, the devotion which we bring to this endeavor will light our country and all who serve it. And the glow from that fire can truly light the world. And so, my fellow Americans, ask not what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country.
Now it is time to take longer strides. Time for a great new American enterprise. Time for this nation to take a clearly leading role in space achievement, which in many ways may hold the key to our future on Earth.
We interrupt this program to bring you a special bulletin from ABC Radio.
The presidential motorcade had just passed through heavy crowds in downtown Dallas and was circling through the fringes of the business district when three shots suddenly rang out somewhere in the crowd.
Here is a special bulletin from Dallas, Texas. Three shots were fired at President Kennedy's motorcade today in downtown Dallas, Texas. Ladies and gentlemen, to add to this bulletin from Dallas, Texas, there is a possibility that the president, Mr. John F. Kennedy, has been seriously wounded. President Kennedy and Governor John Connally of Texas were cut down by an assassin's bullet.
We have just learned that Father Huber, one of the two priests called into the room, has administered the last sacrament of the church to President Kennedy. From Dallas, Texas, the flash, apparently official, President Kennedy died at 1 p.m. Central Standard Time, 2 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, some 38 minutes ago.
1 week after the tragic events of November 22, 1963, President Lyndon Johnson established the President's Commission on the Assassination of President Kennedy to investigate the killing of JFK. Better known as the Warren Commission, it determined that Lee Harvey Oswald acted alone. But there are many who doubt the Warren Commission's findings and the controversy over whether the murder was committed by a lone gunman or was part of a conspiracy that continues to this day. One of those who disputes the idea that a lone gunman killed President Kennedy is my guest today, former county commissioner and Allegheny County coroner and medical examiner Dr. Cyril Wecht, an internationally recognized forensic pathologist and longtime critic of the Warren Commission. Among his many books is Cause of Death, which assails the single bullet theory. He joins me now in Studio A. Dr. Wecht, thank you for making time for us today. Welcome to Essential Pittsburgh.
Thank you, Paul. It's a pleasure to be with you. Thank you for inviting me.
If you have a comment or question for our guest, you can join the conversation by calling 412-246-2002. That's 412-246-2002. Our email address is esspgh@wesa.fm, and you can reach us on Twitter at esspgh and follow the conversation at #EPLive. Who do you think killed JFK? What would you like to ask our expert, Dr. Cyril Wecht? 412-246-2002, the number to call. I'd like to start, Dr. Wecht, by having you tell us where you were and what you were doing when you heard that President Kennedy had been assassinated.
It would seem that I'm making this up. I was standing in the autopsy room of the Los Angeles County Medical Examiner Coroner's Office with my good friend, who remains my dear friend and colleague today, Dr. Thomas Noguchi, at that time the deputy medical examiner of L.A., then later to become the chief deputy. We had met and become friends at the American Academy of Forensic Sciences annual meetings in Chicago as a young man in 62. In 63, I had been consulted in the case. I was in California, having flown out the night before. I met Tom then at his office on that Friday. We were standing in the autopsy room, and we were looking at various cases, one of which was a gunshot victim of a homicide. His secretary came in, whispered into his room. Tom's pallor became pale, waxen, and then he told me what his secretary had just disclosed to him. We immediately adjourned to a nearby restaurant that had a TV set and sat there for the next couple, 3 hours following the events as they unfolded. So that's where I was. And obviously, it's a question that has been asked of people who are older, and everybody without fail, I would say 12 or 15 years of age or older at that time, does recall where he or she was.
After President Kennedy died, a rather hasty military autopsy was performed. Explain what was done here and why you are critical of it.
Well, let's start at Parkland Hospital, where the president was taken immediately following the shooting. The doctors worked feverishly. There was nothing they could do. They saw a wound in the front of his neck, and they saw a big gaping defect on the right side of his skull. There ensued an ugly confrontation with local officials who had the legal authority to perform the autopsy there. The feds, with hands on guns and a lot of profanity and physical threats, had the way, of course, as you would expect, and they left with the body. Actually, setting aside the propriety and question of legitimacy, the passage of time would have been of no consequence. This was not a case like JonBenet Ramsey or O.J. Simpson, where a determination as to when the death occurred would have been highly critical. We knew when, where, how, and so on. So actually, the passage of time should have been beneficial because it gave the people who were going to do the autopsy opportunity to talk with the doctors at Dallas, something that is so important in gunshot wound cases, especially where surgical procedures have been undertaken before the individual dies, to find out from the surgeon what they did and make sure that, you know, there has not been any unintentional obscuration of wounds, et cetera, via the surgical procedures. So the autopsy was performed that evening at Bethesda Naval Center just outside Washington, D.C. This is the absolutely incredible thing that people are amazed to hear. And I want to make it very clear. There's no question this is a matter of hard fact, harsh reality. The two people in charge of the autopsy, pathologist at Bethesda, Commander Humes and Commander Boswell, had never done a single gunshot wound autopsy in their entire careers. This was a case that would have been extremely complicated for a trio of eminent, outstanding, highly experienced forensic pathologists. You had to determine with multiple gunshot wounds in Kennedy the sequence, the trajectory, the distance, the internal ramifications. Then you had to correlate those wounds with the wounds that John Connolly had sustained in his back and wrist and thigh. A very, very difficult procedure.
Why weren't the experts brought in then?
Excellent question. What was the common flaw that the foremost forensic pathologists in the United States of America shared at that time? What was it?
The common flaw?
Common flaw. Civilian status.
Okay. So it had to be civilian, a military?
Well, not that it had to be, not from the standpoint that there was something written in law that this was military, but it had to be military so that it could be controlled. You see, we came to learn. They never disclosed this. It wasn't found out until years later. There were about 30 people in and out of the autopsy room that night, including three-star generals and admirals, giving orders and telling them what to do and what not to do when further dissection was being contemplated and suggested by a third pathologist brought over from the Armed Forces Institute of Pathology, Pierre Fink by name, from Washington, D.C. No, the civilian, the top people, one of whom had been my mentor, the person under whom I trained in Baltimore, Russell Fisher, Milton Halpern in New York City, Alan Moritz in Boston, Joe Spellman in Philadelphia, Joffrey Mann in Virginia. These were the heavyweights. I had attended lectures given by them at the AFIP during the 2 years that I was in the military, well known to the government, utilized by them in different ways, not only for educational purposes, but for actual cases. So they're excluded because they are not going to take orders from military people. They're not going to put their reputations on the line, compromise their 30, 40, 50 years in the business, their reputations in futuro after they're dead, because a general tells them what to do or not to do in an autopsy. So the point that I'm making is to follow through. This is not criticism of an intellectually condescending nature just to make a point by way of being a Warren Commission critic. Let me now quickly follow through and tell you what this is all about. These two incompetent pathologists missed the bullet hole in the president's neck. They did not even see it. As I say to audiences every time I talk, turn around, look at the person to your right or left. Do you think you would have to be a doctor with 4 years of medical school and 5 years of pathology training to see a hole in someone's neck? So how do they miss it? Because the doctors in Dallas had performed the tracheostomy. When the brain has been damaged and the brain can't function and take over and control the heart and lung functions, you've got to do the brain's job. So you do a tracheostomy, you suction out carbon dioxide, you put in oxygen, you take out mucus and blood, and you try to keep the person alive while the surgeons are dealing with the wounds. So they had to enlarge that bullet hole in the neck because it was too small to attach the cuff from the respirator machine. They did not do it in a malevolent or deceitful fashion. They did what was necessary because, quite fortuitously, the bullet that had gone through the president had ripped through the trachea. So they had their tracheostomy already made for them. They just needed to expand that hole. These incompetent guys that night never knew that there was a bullet hole. What did they conclude with a bullet hole in the back that they found as a wound of entrance? They said that when the president lay on his back, the doctors applied external cardiac massage to the front of his chest, and that pressure applied anteriorly forced a bullet, which they knew had penetrated deeply beyond the length of an adult man's finger, back out through the same channel. In other words, like when I came over through the Armstrong tunnels this morning to be with you, if I put my car in reverse, I would have just backed up. Well, guess what? Bullets don't work that way. When a bullet goes into a body, it produces hemorrhage. It produces swelling of the tissues. It becomes encased. It becomes entrapped. It doesn't move around like a car in and out of a tunnel. But it wasn't until the next morning that they learned, when they called the doctors in Dallas, that they had missed a bullet hole in the front of the president's neck. Now, I want to point this out and emphasize
and that, it. And that would indicate that there was somebody there. This kind of goes with the theory that there was a second gunman, and if there was, he was in front of the president,
well,
which that would prove.
Yes. It's interesting because Dr. Perry, the chief surgeon at Parkland, who performed the tracheostomy, and this is a highly experienced guy, and I just want to remind everybody, Dallas was one of the major murder capitals in America. In other words, you're not talking – and Parkland was a major trauma center. So these guys knew gunshot wounds. You're not talking
they
about
were used
some,
to seeing
some
this
neophytes.
Kind of
exactly. Dr. Perry, to his dying day, said that the wound in the neck was a wound of entrance. Now, following through on that, at our recent 3-day JFK conference at Duquesne University, which was an absolutely fantastic program, everybody who's involved in this case will remember this to their dying day. Dr. Robert McClellan, one of the other chief surgeons, spent an hour with us live TV. This wonderful man, 82 years old, spoke lucidly, succinctly, and unhesitatingly. He was there right at the president's head, on the right side, looking into that big defect. And he was there 8 to 10 minutes holding a retractor while the other doctors performed the tracheostomy. And Dr. McClellan said unequivocally that that was a gunshot wound of entrance that had struck the president in the right frontotemporal area, that's just above and slightly in front of the ear, and moved posteriorly. Exactly the opposite of what the Warren Commission report concluded. So
the doctor is saying, just to paint the picture here.
Yeah, go ahead.
He said that the massive wound in the back of President Kennedy's skull had to be an exit wound.
Exactly.
And that because it was an exit wound, it proves that a shot had been fired from in front of the president's limousine, and that means a second gunman was involved.
You've got it, Paul. That puts it clearly and succinctly out there. And, you know, that's what this is all about, Paul. It's not about Oswald completely. And as I say to audiences, I personally don't believe Oswald was a shooter. We can get into that if time permits. But it's not my purpose, my primary objective, to, in a kind of a retrospective fashion, exculpate Oswald. I say to those people who still believe in the Warren Commission report, you want Oswald as a shooter? Fine. You can have him as a shooter. That's not the issue. The issue is, was there a second gunman? Because that then makes it a conspiracy. That reopens the case. You've got an open murder case, and that is what is the problem for the Warren Commission people who are intelligent, who are competent, who understand things. They are hoist by their own petard. They are stuck with the single bullet theory, which is the sine qua non of the Warren Commission report's conclusion regarding a sole assassin. They're stuck with that. You can't have a second person because then you've got a conspiracy under the laws of every state and the federal government. That is the problem that has confronted them for these past 50 years.
And we are going to comb through all of the details of this and look at the Kennedy assassination. That is the topic of our program, 50 years later, the assassination of JFK. My guest is world-renowned forensic pathologist Dr. Cyril Wecht, and you can join the conversation by calling 412-246-2002. More Essential Pittsburgh coming up on 90.5 WESA. It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer, and we are talking about the assassination of JFK 50 years later with our guest, world-renowned forensic pathologist Dr. Cyril Wecht. Last month, he took part in a Duquesne University symposium marking the 50th anniversary of the assassination. I've heard, Dr. Wecht, people say, look, it's been 50 years. Let it go. Why should we all still be bothered by this? What do you say to that?
Well, it's understandable that people would say that, but I want to respond to that and make people think about it in a more serious and deeply and serious, intensive fashion. This is more than just a murder. And by the way, in that regard, Paul, as you know, especially now, this phenomenon in the real world as well as in the world of TV fiction, cold cases. I'm involved myself now. I'll be testifying next week in a case that goes back about 30 years. I had a case last year out of Philadelphia that went back 45 years. So, you know, murder, there's no statute of limitations. All right, that's number one. You do have a murder. Number two, it's not you or me or our neighbors or so on. You know, friends and families grieve. This was the president of the United States. But now let's go on more than that. Who did this? Why was it done? How can we ignore the assassination of a president? We know, and I always wrap up my discussion, but I'll get to it here earlier with you today by pointing out, we know, and there's no dispute between the Warren Commission supporters and sycophantic, parasitic defenders on the one hand and the Warren Commission critic on the other hand, we know that the Russians, the Chinese, and the Cubans were not involved. So I always say, in the words of that wonderful...
How do we know that?
That's indisputable. That has been checked and rechecked. And believe me, you won't find 1 minute of a discussion or dispute if you were to go back and check through all of the dialogues and programs and controversies and debates and so on, believe me, there's just no question about that. So what does it mean then, Paul?
Well, you know what? Let's leave a cliffhanger here and let you get back to that.
All right. I
want to take a call from Alex in Squirrel Hill, our number 412-246-2002. Alex, welcome to Essential Pittsburgh. You're on with Dr. Cyril Wecht.
Hi, Dr. Wecht. I just want to first and foremost laud you for the stupendous, tremendous job that you do advocating for deceased individuals and their families here in Allegheny County. You've had a long career, I'm aware of.
That definitely deserves
a lot of respect.
Well, thank you very much, sir.
You're welcome. On the issue of John Fitzgerald Kennedy's death, I believe that you hit the nail on the head when you say there must be a reopening of this case. JFK was not only murdered or assassinated, JFK never received a fair hearing. And I base this on several primary sources. First and foremost, a close reading of the Warren Commission, as I'm sure you know, just provides an insight into the way the Congress basically swept things under the rug. A close reading of the screenplay for Oliver Stone's film, JFK, highlights the fact that there was only one trial ever brought before a judge in the United States of America. That was the trial of the gentleman from Louisiana,
right.
Clay Shaw.
Right. You're basing that on that is what the movie JFK, Oliver Stone's movie, is based on. That's a case that actually happened.
Well, yes.
I was
a consultant in that case. But the point I think that the caller was making, Paul, is that that was the only trial. You know what I mean? Related.
Right.
I think that's his point. Without getting into the merits of District Attorney Jim Garrison's case against Clay Shaw, and I could talk about that too if you wanted to.
Why is that the only time? Why is it?
Well, because Oswald was killed. Oswald was murdered on Sunday morning by Jack Ruby. And so that was the end of the case. That's, you see, what it all gets to. And the gentleman who called in, the phrase that he used is as apt and succinct as you can use, being swept under the rug. It was all over. That's what the people involved in this and the people who weren't involved but in charge of the government and everybody, that's what they wanted. Just wrap it up. Oswald's dead. It's all over. Hoover has announced to the world that the investigation is complete. They knew in 24 hours or less that it was a sole assassin. My God, in a routine murder, you don't know that. You have to check things out and take weeks or months to be sure of everything.
So was there pressure on the Warren Commission to basically, was there an idea floating around that, for example, the President Johnson, 1 week after the assassination, okay, investigation underway, we're establishing a commission to look into this. They get to work. Were they under some kind of an edict that we need this to go swiftly and we need to just say we want you to confirm what we believe we already know, that Lee Harvey Oswald was the assassin, he acted alone, there's no conspiracy, everybody go back to doing what you were doing, it's okay, America?
Yes, you summarized it. That's exactly the psychological, political milieu in which the Warren Commission followed through with its mission. They started off with the conclusions already having been arrived at, having been officially proclaimed by J. Edgar Hoover, the omniscient, omnipotent director of the FBI. Lyndon Johnson wanted that report quickly to get rid of the rumors that he himself had been involved somehow in the assassination in order to become president. Everybody wanted to wrap it up. Alan Dulles, ironically, amazingly, had been director of the CIA, dismissed by John Kennedy following the Bay of Pigs fiasco and the other clandestine activities of the CIA that Kennedy became aware of. And this dismissed CIA director then is appointed to the Warren Commission. He, in fact, ran the deliberations. Chief Justice Earl Warren was very busy with his court. The two U.S. senators and the two congressmen were very busy with their legislative duties. Their attendance rate was about 35% to 40% and so on. Alan Dulles made the decisions as to what information would be requested, what records would be submitted from the CIA. He ran the show. And so,
You say the CIA hated Kennedy.
Oh, they did.
And why?
Because Kennedy was so disgusted and angry at the CIA when he came to learn about the things that they were doing. There is a documented moment in his Oval Office with then Senate Majority Leader Mike Mansfield from Montana, in which Kennedy had a piece of paper, a memorandum of some kind, tore it up into many pieces, threw it into the air, and said to Senator Mansfield, "This is what I intend to do to the CIA." When Kennedy came to learn about what the CIA was doing and the assassinations of Allende in Chile, Arbenz in Guatemala, the attempted assassination of Castro with exploding cigars and poison drinks, the Bay of Pigs fiasco, the murder assassinations of the Diem brothers in Vietnam, he became incensed. And it was his intention to get rid of, to reconstruct the CIA, which, by the way—
Some people might ask the question, didn't Kennedy sign off on any of that?
Kennedy signed off on – you know what Kennedy signed off on? And that was the document that was shown at our conference, that the ground troops in Vietnam were going to be removed within a matter of months. That's what Kennedy signed off on, so to speak. Kennedy signed off on – he was developing a kind of a detente with Nikita Khrushchev. The Cold War was warming up. These are things that the military, industrial, CIA complex, the United States of America, was not going to accept. This was not their vision of America. This was a time when you had people like Admiral Cromlin and General Walker who were advocating the dropping of nuclear bombs on Russia. This was a time that the military-industrial complex was pounding their chest and running amok throughout the world. This was not Kennedy's idea of how America should comport itself, and therefore it was unacceptable to him. And of course, it was unacceptable to them. They could not deal with Kennedy in any other way. They were looking at five more years of John Kennedy following his reelection. They were looking probably to be followed by 8 years of Bobby Kennedy. 13 years is a lifetime in the political evolution of a country, a lifetime. They couldn't defeat the Kennedys at the polls. No way, with their power, their charisma, their backing, their supporters, and so on. So how do you deal with that? You just sat back like a hockey game, wait till the third period, a basketball game, wait till the second period, and a baseball game, wait till we come up in the ninth inning? No, there's no way to deal with it.
So you're saying
to eliminate the person, and that is what happened, and that's what it was all about.
It's Essential Pittsburgh on 90.5 WESA. I'm Paul Guggenheimer, my guest, world-renowned forensic pathologist Dr. Cyril Weck, 412-246-2002, the number to call. Let's go to Claude in Swissvale. Claude, welcome to Essential Pittsburgh.
Hello?
Yes, you're on the air with Cyril Weck.
Yes, Dr. Weck, I am curious. Are you familiar with a film, documentary perhaps, that was done in about 2002? I saw it once, and interestingly in itself, is it just has disappeared. I've never seen it since. My wife saw it. And what it was a computer scientist type fellow who it was a new technology. He was studying the bullet trajectories and so forth. And he kept concluding, he was doing it by studying the light rays, the splatter. And he kept concluding, as he presented his spiel on TV, that the shot was definitely coming from the front, but he couldn't understand that, they talk about the grassy knoll and so forth, but that there was, the trajectory wasn't coming from up, it came from down. And he then concluded that it came from the storm source.
So you're saying that this experiment, you saw a documentary in which an experiment showed that the shot couldn't have come from up above, which is where Lee Harvey Oswald was on the sixth floor of the Texas School Book Depository.
Not having to do it from behind. He concluded it came from the front.
Right. That it was not from behind. That it was in fact that it wasn't from above or behind, which is where Oswald was, but from the front, which is where people like Dr. Wecht think that a second shooter may have been located. I'll let you respond, Dr. Weck.
Yeah. Paul, there's no question. This has been demonstrated, as was presented at our conference, through acoustical evidence, through photographic evidence in great detail, that the shot of the head, the first shot of the head, the second shot to strike the president, the first shot hit him in the back, and then a shot in the head, number one, and then a second shot to the head, a third shot in all to strike Kennedy, that the killing shot came from the front. I, however, must respectfully disagree I looked at this, and so have other serious critic researchers, about whether the shots could have been fired from the sewer or the overpass ahead of the car. And it just doesn't fit in.
So where were the, where were those shots? If they were, if there was a second shooter and a shot came from the front, where did it come from?
He was behind the picket fence on the grassy knoll. That is where the second shooter was.
You received permission in 1972 to examine the Warren Commission's evidence, including Oswald's rifle and the single bullet. What did you find?
Yes, I got in. That's a whole story in and of itself, but I won't take up our time in telling you how I got in, except to note that supposedly all the autopsy materials are to be sequestered for 75 years based upon a cockamamie so-called executive order that said that everything belonged to Jacqueline Kennedy, who then on paper transferred it back to the government with that proviso. There was an exception that after 5 years, a recognized expert in the field of pathology with a serious historic purpose could apply. I finally got in, and in 1972, I went there. What did I find? I found that a memorandum of April 26, 1965, giving all of this to Mrs. Kennedy, and then compared to a memorandum of October 29, 1966, 1.5 years later, in which she gives everything back to the government. Guess what? What's missing? A metal container holding the president's brain, various photographs, various x-rays, microscopic tissue slides that we look at to differentiate between entrance and exit wounds. They are missing. Nobody had pointed that out before, including the Ramsey Clark panel set up by then Attorney General Ramsey Clark in April of 1968, 4.5 years after the Warren Commission. That was a page one story, August 27th, 1972, by one of the senior reporters in the New York Times at that time, Fred Graham, who had helped me get in when Burke Marshall, the executor of the agreement, was stonewalling me. So that brain missing remains missing 41 years later.
So you were the guy that discovered this.
Yes.
And we still don't know where the president's brain is?
That's right. Not accounted for. Now, you're going to hear from Warren Commission supporters, the Kennedys took the brain and so on. Well, they had every right, legally, morally, ethically, religiously, to take it if they wanted to. But you will not find one sentence, one memorandum of any kind, formal, informal, that indicates that the Kennedy family ever took that brain.
So
if they wanted to, they had a right to, and they certainly would not be delighted about people talking of their father, brother's brain for decades thereafter. They would have simply said, we took the brain and we buried it with the body. End of story.
So if they
that
took
has
it,
never
they,
happened.
They would have said that.
Exactly.
And if they didn't take it, then who has it, and why would somebody take the president's brain? Yeah.
Well, we'll deal with why. When a brain has been traumatized severely, you can't examine it in a fresh state. The brain is a very dense liquid as much as it is a solid. When it has been traumatized by bullets, you can't cut it to examine the trajectory through the brain. It'll fall apart. You fix it in formalin that hardens it, gives it an entirely different consistency. You do that for 2 weeks. You come back, and then you serially section the brain, as you would, and I don't mean to be insensitive, the least bit
frivolous. You're just speaking as a,
I mean,
as
but
a
just
scientist.
So people understand, like a hard-boiled egg that you slice it and you lay out each slice. And what does that permit you to do? Then you would see the trajectories of the bullets as they course through the brain. If you go back to the autopsy report and the Warren Commission, December 6th, 1963, they went back 2 weeks later, and there is a sentence, the brain is not serially sectioned, that means parallel fashion. The brain is not serially sectioned in order to preserve the specimen. Who? Preserve it for whom? What, a display? To give it to Jacqueline Kennedy? To give it to the president's children when they got older? Preserve for whom? And as to who has it, I can't tell you, the individual, but it's all part of the cover-up, which continues to this day with the sequestration still of 1,171 documents containing perhaps about 50,000 pages of materials that the government still has not released on a according to them, just a terrible, tragic murder, but from a medical forensic scientific standpoint, a simple case. Oswald killed the president. He alone shot him. These are the wounds, et cetera. Why are you covering up? Why are you holding back things? What is the problem here?
Those are the questions, and we're talking about them with renowned forensic pathologist Dr. Cyril Wecht here on Essential Pittsburgh. We do need to take a break, but we will come back and take your questions at 412-246-2002. Those of you who are waiting patiently on the line, we will get to you. It's Essential Pittsburgh on 90.5 WESA. It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. My guest is world-renowned forensic pathologist Dr. Cyril Wecht. We're talking about the JFK assassination 50 years later, the anniversary coming up 2 weeks from today, November 22nd. It was November 22nd, 1963 that it happened. If you have a comment or question for our guest, Dr. Wecht, 412-246-2002. Let's go to Joe in Oakland. Joe, thanks for waiting. You're on with Dr. Wecht.
Hello, Dr. Wecht. I, too, applaud you for your untiring work with so many of these autopsies. You talked to the alumni banquet group at the School for Blind Children years ago.
That was a pleasure. Thank you, sir.
I'm sorry I'm so vague about this. I heard just a snippet of a book written by an Australian retired police officer who was very interested in all kinds of investigative work, and he apparently has some testimony in his book, either from a Secret Service employee or somebody from the CIA. Are you at all aware of that kind of a book, that kind of
work? Yes, I am aware. I've had some correspondence of an ongoing nature with a few people in Australia. In fact, I was invited there some years ago to give a bunch of lectures, one of which was on JFK. It's an interesting book. There's a whole host of books out there, I should mention, Paul, for your listeners. And some support the Warren Commission, and others show in more detailed analytical fashion why the Warren Commission report is pure fiction. But thank you, sir, for referring to the Australian book. I'm sorry, I don't recall the name of it offhand.
To Kill a President.
Oh, okay, good, yeah. And it does have some good, interesting information in there. Thank you, sir.
Thank you, Joe. We appreciate the question. 412-246-2002, the number to call. In 1978, Dr. Wecht, you testified before the House Select Committee on Assassinations. You were the lone dissenter on a 9-member forensic pathology panel reexamining the assassination of JFK. Why haven't others reached the conclusion that you have? Why would others in your field be disagreeing with you?
An excellent question. Of course, the answer is you have to ask them. But let me tell you something. Their criticisms of the way in which the autopsy was done, the fact that the gunshot wound to the neck was missed, that a gunshot wound to the back of the head was placed 4 inches higher by the Ramsey-Clark panel 4.5 years later, the fact that the brain was not serially sectioned, the fact that Commander Humes burned his autopsy notes at his fireplace on Sunday evening, November 24th, they were critical of all of this. There's no way that they can circumvent that. But amazingly, these competent, experienced, knowledgeable forensic pathologists, all board-certified people that I know quite well, they nevertheless came to the conclusion that somehow, despite everything, that the Warren Commission got it right. The answer, in part, I can tell you, is this, and I don't say it disrespectfully. I've already acknowledged their expertise. But they never really got into the detailed studies. A lot of things were withheld. Some of the things were not known to them at that time. Acoustical evidence in great detail, photographic analysis. They were, kind of led in a way. They knew what their mission was, And I must say this, quite frankly, they were all well-connected with the governmental agencies here and there, this national committee, this being a member of the faculty at the AFIP or the FBI Academy, all the things which I had done, by the way, until the mid-1970s or so, or earlier, when I came out, then I was no longer invited to be a presenter at the AFIP or FBI Academy lectures on forensic pathology, no longer invited to be a member of various national committees. I just say that not with sour grapes, but the point I'm making is that these are the things, you know, that were on their minds.
And these fellows didn't necessarily have access to some of the things that you had access to, particularly in 1972 when you looked at evidence at the National Archives. Let's go to Brian and Sue Wickley, who has an interesting question. Brian, welcome to Essential Pittsburgh.
Yes, Dr. Wecht, hello.
Hello.
My question is, I'm wondering if you heard of the theory that the fatal shot could have been fired accidentally by the Secret Service man in the car behind President Kennedy. He had an AR-15. And the fact that it's unlikely that a full metal jacket bullet would have caused the type of wound that was seen in the president, that the huge portion of the skull blown out. And I'll listen offline. I appreciate it very much.
Thank you, Brian. This has been a recent theory that we've been hearing about.
In fact, I think it was a television program too recently on, is it Reels TV or something like that. The answer is yes. I'm quite familiar with that. As a matter of fact, it was originally propounded in a book by a gentleman named Bonar Menninger, and then revived more recently by somebody else who wrote this book. While, you know, again, I don't mean to be dismissive or disrespectful of somebody else's theories, I can only tell you that it simply doesn't work out with the trajectory when you get into the forensic scientific, rentgenological, neurosurgical analysis of the head wound. Insofar as the nature of the wound and whether it could have been caused by this kind of ammunition and so on, that's not quite correct. When you have a bullet that strikes the head in tangential fashion as opposed to essentially perpendicular fashion going in and straight across, if it comes in tangentially, it will blow out calvarium, top of the skull. It will blow out underlying brain tissue to a great extent.
We have a question from Owen, who asked this off the air. He is from Scott Township. He asks, what can we learn from Bobby Kennedy's assassination? And this, of course, President Kennedy's younger brother, at that time a U.S. senator who was running for president in 1968, so 5 years later, RFK assassinated. And he wants to know if there is any information that we can derive from that assassination to help in coming to conclusions about JFK's assassination.
Well, you can't come to a conclusion of a scientific nature based on what happened with Bobby Kennedy. You can come to a conclusion as a reasonably intelligent person as to the political connections between the two assassinations. Insofar as the assassination of Bobby Kennedy is concerned, Paul can invite me back another time and we'll talk about that case in which I was officially consulted by Dr. Tom Noguchi, the chief medical examiner of Los Angeles. Let me toss this out, Paul. We don't have time to get into it, and these people can get back in touch with you later on. Ask people, and I'm not going to give you the answer, ask people to write in or phone to you as you wish, what was the distance approximately, you know, to be precise, what was the distance between Sirhan's gun and Bobby Kennedy's wounds? Sirhan in front. When he shot the senator who had just won the Democratic primary in California, which was tantamount to getting the nomination for president in 1968, he's walking through the pantry kitchen area of the Ambassador Hotel when Sirhan is there, and Sirhan then picks up his gun and shoots at Kennedy as Kennedy is approaching him. Call in, write in to Paul. Let him know what you think the distance was, and then we can talk about this another time. Paul can arrange it, and I'm going to tell you what has been shown unquestionably and unequivocally to have been the distance you will be a little surprised.
Okay, and just so that we're not completely teased here, I mean, do you think that these assassinations are related?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Let's go to John in Penborough. John, welcome to Essential Pittsburgh. Hi, John, are you there?
Dr. West, could you give us your best thoughts on where the bullet was shot from that entered the throat? It was declared to be an entrance wound.
You know, that's an excellent question. You know, I'm not comfortable being equivocal or punting, as we say, but I got to tell you, I'm a little confused myself, and I'm not embarrassed or hesitant to tell you because I got to be honest. Dr. Perry, who was there and who handled that, insisted that it was a wound of entrance. My problem with that is if it is a wound of entrance, then you've got a wound of entrance on the back, unquestionably. Where did those two bullets go? You see what I mean? That's been my problem. The wound, regrettably, was never traced out. You've got to dissect out wounds like I did the other night when I did the two homicides and suicide from Westmoreland County, a whole bunch of gunshot wounds, and I had to trace them all out. And it did not involve the president, and yet I had to do a thorough job, the kind of job that should have been done, obviously, with the president of the United States. But that's an excellent question. So that is kind of up in the air. It had all the appearances, I can tell you that, of a gunshot wound of entrance. My problem is, as I've said, if it were entrance, where did it go? And if the entrance in the back, well, it was entrance in the back, that's unquestionable. Nobody disputes that. Where did that bullet go? That's the problem.
All right. We have just a few minutes left, so we're going to have to go quickly. But we will take one last call here from Patrick in Butler. Patrick, go ahead very quickly with your comment or question, please.
I have a question or comment from Dr. Weck. You know, Nick Perry couldn't fix the lottery without people finding out. And what my question, Dr. Weck, is how, after all these years, with all the conspiracy that people wave into, all these people involved in the conspiracy to shoot the president, kill the president, why there hasn't been one, what he thinks about, there hasn't been a deathbed confession. You know, nobody's wife has said my husband was involved, my boyfriend, et cetera, was involved. And I have to get the doctor's comment on Vincent Bugliosi's, the man who convicted Manson, Bugliosi's book that concluded that Oswald was a single shooter. I appreciate that, sir.
All right. Thank you,
all
Patrick.
Right. Well, let me start.
We have to go.
Yeah, okay. Very, very quickly. Yeah. Vince Bugliosi and I have become friends and so on. And I just disagree with him. What more can I say on that? We just have a strong disagreement with regard to his support.
Right, and so Patrick's asking, if there was a conspiracy, how could it be hushed up this long?
Well, you got to understand the people you're dealing with, sir. You're not dealing with people like you or me. You know, we're just ordinary patriots. When we see the flag flying and hear the Star Spangled Banner, that's different from what the super patriots, they understand America in a much deeper, more reflective fashion than we do. And one additional comment on that. How could that be? What did you just learn? What have we just learned as American citizens about the NSA? What have we just learned that the President of the United States just found out that the NSA has been eavesdropping on the Chancellor of Germany, the President of Mexico, governmental officials throughout the world, and so on. The President of the United States, after 5 years, just learned that. So right. When the question arises, you know, how can things be kept a secret? There you are, sir.
Good point. All right, a couple quick things. An email from Chris and Moon, who asks, in today's political climate, is it more or less likely that a political figure could be – that someone could assassinate a political figure and get away with it?
You're not going to assassinate any political figure just because you disagree. It's got to be a political figure that you cannot deal with in any other way, like John Kennedy, like Bobby Kennedy, like Martin Luther King. You can't deal with them in any way other than to eliminate them.
When will we, Dr. Wecht, we're under a minute now, when will we, the American people, have the answers and finally be able as a nation to put an end to this mystery and no longer be haunted by the assassination of JFK?
Another generation or two is going to be required for the people to feel that it's acceptable. It will be okay for the American public to learn what happened. I used to think it was going to be in my lifetime. I know that's not going to happen. Another generation or two, this will be disclosed. I won't be around, but I hope in some way I'll find out.
My guest has been the world-renowned forensic pathologist, Dr. Cyril Weck. Dr. Weck, thank you so much for being with us here today on Essential Pittsburgh.
Paul, I thank you for inviting me. It's been a pleasure chatting with you, and maybe we can have a follow-up sometime.
That would be wonderful. Thank you again, sir. And thanks to all of you for listening to Essential Pittsburgh on 90.5 WESA. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. Have a great weekend.